I thought it would be good to start to find out what you did before you got involved on this project. Were you from Omaha originally?
No, I was from Herman, Missouri, born and raised in Herman. And see, that's 7 miles from Gasconade, where the engineer department had a base. And the reason they had a base there, it was a safe winter harbor for their boats, to put them in the Gasconade, get them out of the Missouri River ice in the winter. So therefore, they had yards, I forget the dates, but way back, I think this one, a Gasconade, started somewhere like around 1900, in that range. And the one previous to that was below Jeff City it's right where the Algoa Farms is today. It's a penal farm. The name evades me. Anyway, it's before my time. Well, anyway, this boatyard was always a good place for us to work. We were only 7 miles away, and that activity was at its best when I came out of high school in 1923. And, well, every young man has a more or less ambition to go out. And it's hard, as a rule, to find it at home unless you work for a pretty meager salary. And I had watched these boats go up and down the river from a kid on up, you know. And it's fascinating, you know. And so then when they started in, they had what they called the master plan of reconstructing the Missouri River, or Missouri River Improvement, rather, program, which started roughly in 1925. And so my working days started right when they were at their best, you might say. At that time, they employed about 1,500 men in the yards, and today they have two. One motor boat that they use for to check the river. You see, all the work was finished roughly in about the 50s or late or in the 60s, I would say. And the dikes had been put in, and the river changed according to their specifications, all the way from Sioux City to the mouth. And instead of farmers having to pull their barns and homes from the river, they used to have them on skids. But if the river decided to wash their land away, which it would do, the floodplain was from bluff to bluff, you know. And whatever side it wanted to move to, that's what it would do. That was the characteristics of the Missouri, and also the Mississippi below the mouth of Missouri. So they worked themselves out of a job. By 1960, 65, the work was completed. And today they have a little maintenance work, but the river is really in excellent shape, where they come through home now with 12 barges. The maximum is 12. As a rule, they have 9. Both upstream and downstream, loaded to 8.5, 9 feet. And the reason they can't take more on the Missouri is because the bends are too sharp. You just can't take any more. If you have more than 12, the stern's on the bank, and the bow is just about touching the bank, and the middle of the toe would be out on the sandbar, so to speak. In other words, it just isn't enough room for more. But they do take 12, which is a decided change when you think of a 9-foot draft with 12 barges. Whereas when they started working, the Daniel Boone was an engineer department boat that drew 3.5 feet of water, and it would be aground. This is hard to believe, but it's a fact.
And so this whole boatyard then was a Corps of Engineers.
Uh-huh. That's right.
And so is Once you finished high school, just go there and apply for a job? Or?
Well, yes. I actually worked for Kroger Grocery and Baking in my first year out of high school. And then I figured, well, this is no good. You're confined to four walls the rest of your life, and you get 2 weeks off of your vacation, and I thought, that's not for me.
Uh-huh.
So I went to work for Woods Brothers Construction Company, a contractor, and operating a motorboat. And then finally, I thought, I'm not educated enough to be a superintendent or anything. You're kind of at the top of your ladder when you get up to be a chief clerk or something in the office or something. And I was a material clerk. And so then I decided, no, I'll take a wage cut and go to work as a deckhand. A deckhand, you had to have 36 months experience, you see, to qualify for a pilot's license, which is quite a long time. And incidentally, you'd push 10 ton of coal a day into these bins. That's what the boat I started on, the Baldwin, E.M. Baldwin, would burn up in a day. And so every day, we had two deckhands. One would take one side, one would take the other. And we'd wheel in 5 ton of coal apiece. And I thought I had a good job. I really did.
Were you actually shoveling the coal?
Well, we would shovel the coal in the wheelbarrows and then wheel it in and dump it. We'd run up a stage plank off the barge, and when we got to this big kind of a, we have it closed up when we, if we want to make the boat look pretty, we'd close it up. But ordinarily, these two big holes were open there about 5 foot by 4 foot square, where we just dumped these wheelbarrows in the bin, and then the firemen would shovel it out into the boilers.
Now, was that, that was the first job that you would do as a deckhand, the kind of...
Yes, mm-hmm.
And was it, would this be on a boat like the stern wheeler that you showed?
Yes, mm-hmm. Only it was steam. And although I had a good captain to work for, which was another incentive, he was a local boy, very nice fella, Gilbert Kirchner, and I got some very good training. You know, being a captain of a boat, you have to nearly have your father or uncle or somebody be there ahead of you so that you could break into this, because it's just ordinarily not done. Today, they go to school at Helena, Arkansas, and in about 6 months of in the school, and they have 6 months training on board a boat, and they get a pilot's license. But I still think that the old way was better, really serving apprenticeship. It was took a little longer, but I think you learned a lot more actually doing it than out of a book, really.
Did you have to do some study? Did you have to study navigation? Or?
Yes, we had to study. We had to pass a Coast Guard exam. When I took my first exam, it was with the Department of Commerce. Later, this was all absorbed by the Coast Guard, and it's still part of the Coast Guard today. And then every time, it took me about 3 days to pass the exam. And then you have to draw up the map of what you want, what route you want. Like, say, my first was from the mouth of the river to Kansas City, because I put in most of my time on the Missouri River. And that's all I knew. In fact, I was very content with that. I expected to stay there. But then in 1934, when this project started here, I came up here as a deckhand. See, I still didn't have my 36 months then. I got my license after it was up here, Fort Peck.
So you passed the exam, but you didn't have enough time yet to be
a pilot.
A pilot.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
So.
And when, just to clarify, when you said you had to draw a map, does that mean you had to draw a map of all the hazards in the river and?
That's right.
To prove that you.
That's right.
You knew what was going on.
Like up here, I had a stretch from the mouth of Yellowstone. After we got up here to the mouth of Musselshell River. And since I had my license already, this year would be an added portion to it. And but that was enough to satisfy the Fort Peck District. And then, see, by law, all steam vessels at that time had to have licensed personnel, and the engineer department, they more or less insisted on licensed personnel too on their diesel boats. See, the John Ordway up here, that was a diesel boat.
Now, did you come up on the John Ordway?
Yes, as a deckhand.
Uh-huh. Why don't you tell about that again, like you were showing me on the picture, so it's on the tape, about how the river was so shallow and you had to use the motorboats.
Well, in that year, 1934, it was a very drought year, and the river was very low. We left Gasconade, the engineer department base, in July the 2nd, and we got up to Kansas City about 5 days later, and that's where the boats were accepted by the engineer department, formally accepted. And then we went on up the river, and we had good luck all the way up to Sioux City and up to Yankton. And then the river just got shallower and shallower, and there wasn't enough water to float the boats. The boats drew about a little over 3 feet, 3 feet, about 3 inches. And we'd have 2.5 feet, some places 2 feet. And the farther up the river we'd go, the shallower it got. And Sioux City is roughly mile 800. And Mobridge, South Dakota, oh, just offhand, I don't know what that is. But I would say that it's roughly 1,200, something like that. Sometimes we'd make a mile a day. we have to. You see, if you'd come up against a sand reef that would go from shore to shore, you just butt the boat up against it in the deepest portion. And then we'd run out of hawser line. We'd either dig a, what they call a dead man. It was a log that we'd dig in with a trench down to it. We'd fill it up with dirt. And we'd have a line around it, and that would be our anchorage. We'd want it so we'd go pretty in a beeline to where we wanted to go. And then we'd run that back to the boat. Sometimes a coil of line is roughly 1,200 feet. And sometimes we'd have to run out another 1,200 or 2,400 feet of cable so we'd get to where we wanted to get to. And often we'd have to maybe dig a couple of anchorages on a crossing. That's quite interesting, a lot of work, but when you're young, it's kind of fun.
Had that been was that a sort of standard procedure for a boat that when the river was too shallow, or did you kind of have to invent this as you were going along?
Well, years ago, the boats that came up here, you know, up to Fort Benton, and that was mile 2,280, Fort Benton, Montana, from the mouth. Those boats, they had spar poles on the sides. If you've seen pictures of the Far West and the General Meade, they all had these big poles on the bow, and they would have blocks and tackles whereby from their steam capsons or winches on the deck, They'd have these block and falls with a lot of perches, and they'd sock this pole or spar into the bed of the river. Let's assume they were aground, or on shallow water. Then they'd put that in on this side, and they'd put pressure on it from the top, literally raise this boat up, and push ahead with the paddle wheel, and they'd do the same thing on the other side. They called it grasshoppering. They'd literally kind of walk their way across the shallow spot. That's the way often in low water they'd get up the river. And, this is a matter of history. That's before my time, but...
It still sounds like you'd really have to love the life to do that kind of work.
Well, that's... I imagine they liked it as well as I did, really.
Uh-huh.
The reason I know this stuff, I've read up on it quite a bit, and I work in a museum at home, a River Room Museum.
Oh.
Incidentally, it's one of the best.
Okay.
I brought you some literature.
Oh, good.
And that's why I know most of this data. So you can tell people.
Yeah.
And surprising how many people are interested in the river, really.
Yeah.
And also in the improvement work.
Well, it has a lot of, romance and mystery to it, I think, for people in the West, where water was so important. And
that's right.
They
are very important. They have been through our history and still are today. And they're fascinating.
I have to ask you, did you read Mark Twain when you were a kid?
Yes.
Did that inspire you?
Well, not necessarily. When I read Mark Twain, I used to walk around a bluff east of Herman to a farmer and get milk every morning, all from the age of 6 on in grade school. And I'd get a gallon bucket of milk. And that took me by winter, and most of your school days are in winter, And there was a watchman there, had a fire in a little shack that guarded the crossings. So the wagons that would come, if there was a train due, he'd flag the wagons so their teams wouldn't get, run away on the wrong side of the tracks. Often, an engine would shy a team of horses. And so I'd stop at this watchman's shack and warm up. And if it was fall or spring, I'd watch these. It was a Missouri River Navigation Company out of Kansas City. And they had three boats, the Chester and the A.M. Scott. They were propeller boats. And... I think some of the first propeller boats out, and they were steam, and then they had the Advance, which had a massive wheel, paddle wheel, and when these boats would go by with their waves and all that, this is fascinating. You wonder where they're going, It is kind of fascinating.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I imagine... You see, that happened long before I read Mark Twain. So this is kind of instilled into you as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Well, I guess we should get on to Fort Peck. But
yeah.
How long did it then take to get?
Well, I tell you what we did then. That in Mobridge, we got to what they call Blue Blanket Island, and that was shale, and you couldn't wash shale. And it was getting so late in the year, and we couldn't go any farther because we just couldn't go over this shale. And so they decided to drop back to Mobridge a little ways, and they ordered up a couple of carloads of piling, and they made a set of skids and pulled these two boats out on the bank for the winter. And they block them up, jack them up, and block them up so they set level. And then the next spring, then after the ice was out, you know, then they dropped them back down on these skids and slid them back in the water. And then they decided they'd only need really one, and so they sent the Patrick Gas back down to the Omaha district.
So it never even got all the way up here?
And that's
the second boat.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They didn't bring the second one. And so then we had the John Ordway, and incidentally we came up in roughly 3 weeks, left down there sometime in April, about May the 15th or so, we were up here. Didn't take too long. See, we had ample water. Uh-huh. Spring of the year, you always have a certain amount of runoff from snow and whatnot, and then rainfall also in that time of the year.
How did you spend that winter?
We all went back either home or, in my case, I went back down to the yards at Gasconade, which was 7 miles from home, and I worked in the yards as a welder helper that winter. And then the next spring came back up on the boat.
Was this 1934?
That was 35 then.
35.
And we arrived here roughly, I would say, May the 15th or 20th. I forget the date. In May. And it was quite a gallery of people down at the riverbank watching for the boat, although we had that all the way up. Oh. See, there hadn't been a boat come up for 22 years.
Is that right?
And so it was a lot of children that were 22 years old seeing their first boat.
Why hadn't there been any boats?
Well, the Mandan was the last one, a snag boat for the engineer department. There was no activity up here. There were no more boats running, you know, commercial. And so there wasn't really no need for the government to spend any money on this upper end. And until Fort Peck Dam. And then they had hard times finding pilots. They got one from a Captain Leach from Bismarck that was still one of the old line, Coulson line out of Bismarck. Captain Joe Leach. And then we had a Captain Malding, W.I. Malding, that had been on the snag boats in the Kansas City district, and also the Mandan, which run all the way up in this area years ago, you know.
Now, were the snag boats, was that to clear snags?
Yeah, to take the trees out of the river that had fallen in as the river changed course. And so...
Were you still a deckhand at this point?
Still a deckhand. I was a deckhand till I got up to Fort Peck.
Okay.
And then I went over to Dubuque and got my license. And there was a opening here for a pilot. And they had one man here, Captain Leslie, an elderly man. But actually, it took two of us. And this equipment was so large. I forget the dimensions of the dredges. They were around, oh, no doubt you can find it out in their record somewhere. But I do know they were, they had bridges, like the bridge to Nashway was a swinging bridge. And we had roughly a foot clearance on each side when we come through these. And I hated to make people wait. You know, after all, people coming from Nashway or them little towns like Park Grove and Idlewild, those little towns. Maybe it was just shift change time or something, you know. And there we'd gather up quite a gallery. But it would take us sometimes maybe 30 minutes, you know, to get entered, because you couldn't afford to. Once you have a rest, you know, against the piling, which weren't any too strong, the wind is what caused you trouble. We'd have, up here you have some terrific winds. And if it happened to be crosswise, you catch a lot of wind. But once we had a rest, then we'd push on through. But we'd have not much clearance on each side.
Tell me how the job of the boat was to haul the dredges around.
Yeah, that's all we did is move the equipment, the floating equipment. They had floating boosters, and they had floating dredges, four of each. And then they had land boosters, four of each, too. Of course, we didn't bother with those. They were on land and run on rails. But the floating equipment, if they moved a dredge to a different site to start dredging, which, as you notice, these labyrinthed ditches they have, well, those were all different dredge cuts. And when they'd move them, then they'd move the whole line, pipeline, the floating boosters, and all that stuff. And then our daily routine work was with the derrick boats. They had two derrick boats, and they'd lift, if they had to make pump changes, they had a hatch in the roof, they'd pick the hatch off, and they'd have a crew on the hatch, they'd have the dredge shut down, and they'd have a crew in there unbolting the pipes, and they'd pick this whole dredge pump out through the roof, set it on a barge, pick up another one, set it in down in through the roof, and bolt it down, and then they'd bolt the pipes to it. And I think their record time was 4 hours and some odd minutes to make a change. And this was fast.
It must have been a very skilled job to operate that derrick, I would think.
It was, yeah. Uh-huh. Very delicate. They had very good operators. In fact, they made a lot of good men here that came here more or less as a hatchet carpenter, so to speak. And when they left here, they were pretty well versed in what they, and had a lifetime trade. They did a lot of good carpenter work. You know, to build all this equipment out here on the Bald Prairie, they called it the Montana Navy. And it was quite a feat when you really think about it. But they did it. They did a very good job. Like today, I was reading one of their brochures. 50 years, and it's still standing, and evidently in pretty good shape. Yeah. Well, it's so massive, it's hard to comprehend.
Well, when you said the day-to-day work was with those derrick boats, what was the role of the John Ordway?
What we did with the John Ordway, we'd hook up to the derrick boat we could handle. But if we had to move a dredge, then we'd need, especially if we had to go through the narrow bridge at Nashway, or before they had the closure of the dam. Mm-hmm. See, then they dredged up both sides. Mm-hmm. That was for about a year or two, I forget how long it took, until they had the sides so steep and the river was getting pretty well corralled in there. Then they had to bring all the equipment down from the upper side of the dam. You see, what you don't see under the lake bed, it's the same dredge cuts like they are below the dam where they dredged first. And then, of course, that was covered up with the lake. You don't see it. But when they had the closure, what they called the closure, they brought all the equipment down through the little trestle on the upstream berm of the dam, would dump the rock down, you know, through that little passage, and brought all the equipment down below the dam, and then they closed that all off, the closure, and they did that in record time, and I forget what it was. They started in the morning, and by in the afternoon, they were pretty well closed off already. They really dumped the rock in there and closed it off. And then at the same time, the water was being diverted through the tunnels. And then, of course, after that, then they dredged the center in. And it's amazing what these dredges could do. When they pumped into the center, this swift water that was coming through there, they just literally brought up a big sandbar with their discharge, and that all helped stop the flow. And it was quite something. And then after that, of course, then they brought all this up level with the rest and completed the dam.
I'm trying to visualize all this in my mind, never having been to really look at the dam before. But I would imagine that most of the time the John Ordway was on the other side.
On the stern end. Like say if we moved a dredge or a derrick, I'd get on top of the Leverman's house, of the derrick, or the Leverman's house on the dredge, that operated the dredge, on the extreme highest point. And then we'd have motorboats, as a rule, especially like I say, if we had to go through anything narrow, we'd have one motorboat on each side, and then I'd direct the three units. The one on the stern would be the Ordway, and which way to go, because he couldn't see, he's hidden back there. And the other two, they do then what you tell them to do, come ahead this way a little bit, or maybe back up and come ahead on the other one. And that's the way we'd enter something. And
did you use hand signals?
Or? Yes, hand signals.
Uh-huh.
If it were today, we'd probably have radio or something.
Right. You better not, sneeze or scratch your nose at the right time.
But there was good visibility, and it worked very good. And that's about all there is.
Well, did you ever go aground?
We went aground one time, didn't take long, with a derrick boat, where they had left a dredge cut that was just not quite completed. And generally we'd mark these places, but evidently this one was fairly new, and we did push up on this where there was a mound of dirt yet under the surface of the water. In dead water it's hard to see, like if there's current, then you can generally tell what the depth is, by looking at the water. It'll either have a shallow reef in which will show up different little waves, and a deeper water will look different. And but if water is like in a lake, it's pretty hard to determine unless it's fairly close to the top, so it'll show a different ripple. But actually we had no trouble to speak of. They did have one dredge on a closure. The plant section brought through three dredges and boosters. And incidentally, these were square, box-type structures. They had no rake on. You know what I mean? If the current would hit it, it would be hitting a square box, which would really drag you. So we brought three units down complete without any mishaps, and this lower bridge, was as an afterthought, really, to be safe, and they'd have probably done it. They could have dredged it out in a couple of hours, made a right straight channel, instead there was kind of a dog's leg in this where it put you right on the rock protection on the pier of the lower bridge, but we made it each time. But the dredging section took one dredge down, and they, by themselves, with lines, and they hit the core, the sheet piling, and ripped a hole in it. So that delayed them about a day or two or three to build a, what they call a cofferdam around this. And then they padded up with cotton and pumped the water out so they could repair this. And actually the cofferdam serves as a extra hull. Then they could pull it off of this obstruction. But really that wasn't our fault because the dredging section did it themselves. We operated in the plant section. And what we would do is repair the... but that was about the only actual mishap as far as floating equipment goes.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were there ever, I know that in 1936 there was a big storm that wiped out a lot of the houses in the boom town and actually killed
yes.
people.
Yes.
Did that affect, was that kind of off on the prairie or did that?
Yeah, it didn't bother us.
No.
Although we would have some tremendous winds. I never will forget the winds in Montana. They'd blow 3 days one way and it might wait a day, and it might just turn around, blow 3 days. I mean, if you live up here, you've probably seen this. This is typical of the prairie winds. And they're quite strong. They really are. But I always loved Montana. I really still do. I tell you what you like about Montana. It's the people. We used to go out grouse hunting south of Fort Peck. There wasn't any road, a dirt road. From Macon City, we'd go in there and with somebody that lived on that side, go up these dirt roads. And we'd hunt grouse. Sheep herder, we'd see a sheep herder maybe 5 miles or so inland in the Badlands. And he'd get his daughter, sons to watch the sheep. He'd show us where the grouse were. And, well, people, local people, the way I figured it out, they're so sparsely settled, they just appreciate other people. And you have to like them. And likewise, when they would come to town, and we'd take them on board the boat and wine and dine them, so to speak, retaliate. I always said when I got back to Missouri that they talk about Southern hospitality. They don't know what hospitality is till they get up in Montana.
That's a nice compliment.
So it's kind of nice.
How much of a crew did you have on the boat?
Well, we had a captain, a pilot. Captain Leslie was a captain. I was a pilot. And we had an engineer and an assistant engineer, that was four. And we had two deckhands, that was six. And we had a cook, seven.
Now, did all of you come up as a unit from
Corps? Yes, we had a crew of about seven men from Gasconade. Only it was different captains. There was a Captain Malding. And a Captain Kirchner. Gilly Kirchner. No, I take that back. Gilly Kirchner and Bill Heckman went south on the Mowbridge, from Mowbridge, Captain Malding and Captain Leach, the upper river pilot, came up to here. And then up here, Captain Leslie took over. And then when I got a license, I took over, assisted him, which I did before, too.
Did you acted as, also as the pilot?
Yes. He also acted as a pilot. Okay. Stand and watch as a pilot. With the engineer department, if the equipment hadn't been so large, we really needed two men here to function, because the equipment was just too large, and then we didn't really have enough horsepower in some instances. But we just used what we had to an advantage. We might have to back into the winds so the wind wouldn't hit us broadside and get to the point where we were going to go anyway, the long way around, but we'd get there. And then when they had everything surveyed out, like say when they wanted to spot on a dredge cut, a new dredge cut, they'd have two flags the surveyors would put up. And then the idea was to get the spud on the survey line. In other words, they'd pivot on this spud. They dredged in an arc. They had two spuds on the stern end of the dredge. And on the bow of the dredge, they'd have a cable off the port side, a cable off the starboard side, to an anchorage, either on the shore or in the water. And then they'd pull, they'd swing this dredge in an arc, kind of, 160 degrees, something like that, halfway around, you know. And they'd pivot on one. Then when they wanted to step up a little closer to the cut, as they sucked all the sand and stuff away, and the effluent was getting lighter, so then they'd drop, they'd come around to where they were 10 feet ahead, you know. They'd drop that spud, pick up the other spud, then they'd step up that much, see. That's where they kept on a B line going up where the surveyors had it lined out for them to dredge. And
really an amazing
it
process.
Was, yes, it is. Well, every phase of the construction job as a whole was an amazing process. Really, when you visualize the building of the tunnels and the building of the spillway and the hydraulic fill in itself, I'd say there to stay, and it's impervious because it's built so the dredge lines went up to the outer edges, like the downstream toe of the dam from bluff to bluff, and on the upstream toe of the dam from bluff to bluff. And they dropped their effluent on the outer sides as they were going up, like say on a 7-on-1 slope, from the base down there where the roadway is, on up. They always had this pipe clean across from bluff to bluff that was dropping effluent. And then the sand, the water, and the light silt would run to the center, and the heavier sand and stuff would be to the outer edge. And so the center, which was a core pool, that what extra water there was, they'd pump overboard. They always had a spillway built there so it wouldn't cut the dam away, and they had a pump boat up in the core pool that pumped the excess water overboard. But at the same time, all this silt, the fine gumbo mud and silt, would be in the center. And as this compacted down in there, this is gumbo. That's impervious. It's just a solid compacted mass after, you know, all the moisture got out of it. So it's really a marvelous job.
Did you have, on your days off, would you go see what was going on, like at the tunnels part or the spillway?
Well, I went up on the fill especially. The tunnels was more or less taboo. I don't know if you could even get in there without a pass. And much less, furthermore, I didn't really want to go, because that was underground, and it's pretty dangerous work in there. But on the fill, we'd go up on the fill, and we'd pick up buffalo heads, buffalo skulls. And we take them down to the carpenter shop. And there they'd make a plaque. And then the painter, they had a paint shop, a sign painter, he'd paint on there. 1937, Fort Peck dredged Jefferson 50 feet depth or something.
Isn't that something?
I have one down at the museum at Herman that I brought from up here. And it's really amazing how many buffalo skulls are in that fill, in that dam. A lot of them were damaged, but some of them were beautiful specimens. And the nasal capacity, I mean, the nasal part, that was all gone. It was just this hard skull, you know, with the horns. And I don't know, see, a buffalo has a pretty heavy, it's a thick bone up there where the horns are anchored. I don't know how long they'd been in that bottom. There must have literally been tens of thousands of skulls. And this is hard to comprehend. The only way I can figure it out is the buffaloes are clannish, and as they swim the river, no matter where the river was, see, the river was here for thousands of years, and as it meandered, you know, from bluff to bluff, the buffalo would swim it. And every picture you've seen of buffalo, they're always so compacted. And they must, a certain amount, suffocate and drown or something in this crossing. Otherwise, it's hard to account for why there were so many skulls. But there really were a lot of skulls.
Did anything else unusual turn up? Did anybody?
Well, we did find one, it looked like it could have been a part of an old boat. It had a draft mark, like a 3 on it. But then again, it could have been a part of an old ferry or something. But I hung it in the engine room, and I wrote up quite a article. Draft marks visible. A 3, you know, which they were visible. And I said, this is part of the stem post of the steamer Red Cloud, sunk at Fort Peck in whatever year, I forget when it was. I kind of guessed at it, I guess. But then nevertheless, it did sink here, or close here, somewhere, Cow Island or Fort Peck. But anyway, I put this up on a kind of a tool rack there they had in the engine room, and I hung this on there, and I put this little sign under it, and a fellow named Jefferson from the office, he came down, he seen that. He said, you should put this up in the museum, up at the theater, and I had a laugh, and I told him, I said, no. I says, I don't know if that's the truth or not. I made it up.
He didn't know you and, were being a creative historian.
Yeah. But really, it's that's what kind of got me interested in history, was up here. You talk to the natives, and they said, well, the last buffalo was shot up here in 1890, which 1934, that was only 44 years. And it really makes you think how new the country was. And you really begin to be interested in it. It's kind of fascinating.
Did you live on the boat?
Yes, we had our quarters on the boat. And then in the wintertime, we'd lay up the boat and work somewhere else, like down in the floodplain garage or somewhere on the job here, or take vacation time. And we'd stay in the barracks, and we maintained a watchman on the boat. There was nothing to do. See, in the wintertime, they'd get 5 feet of ice some winters, which is a lot of ice. And with a wooden paddle wheel, they tried to start dredging early one year, and And they were repairing the paddle wheel constantly because it just don't work.
When would the first freeze come? Do you remember?
Well, I just don't know. It's generally, I guess, like it is now. In November, for sure.
Were you able to work probably up to into November then?
As a rule, I think, yeah. They'd work as long as they possibly could. And in the spring, of course, they started a little early. Some years they'd break ice with a derrick boat and start in. But things just didn't work too good. But they did kind of jump the gun a little bit. Nearly every spring they'd try to start. Well, they had the work to do, and they wanted to start.
Well, when you lived then in the winter time, did you work on an actual construction project? Or?
Well, I worked one winter in the floodplain garage as a... they had a 100-ton press in there where they pressed out the pins of the cat tracks. This was a garage where they repaired the caterpillars and tractors. And I'd help with that. They had an operator for that. And I'd help there. And then I worked in... different places. Like later on, when the job was over, I went back down to, there was some more work here. So then I went back down. I worked for Federal Barge Lines at St. Louis, out of St. Louis, and as a steersman. And trying to get more license, you know. And I'd run on the Missouri River for Federal. And, but I had a chance for a job up here after I worked there about a year. In 1940, I came back here. Took a year's leave from down there. See, Federal Barge was another government's agency. What they were doing is starting commercial freighting, you know, on the rivers again. And it took a little extra government money to start this out. And later it's all private enterprise. Today it's all private enterprise. But so then I had a chance to come back to Fort Peck on the Sacagawea inspection boat on the lake. So I came up here in the fall, and then we had this boat stored down there in a big building down below the dam down there. And I did everything that winter, waiting for spring to put the boat in. And then the war started, December 15th or 21st, whatever it was. And so it wasn't long. I got a call from Federal Barge Lines, or I mean a letter from Federal Barge Lines, whether I'd be available in April. And about the same day, I got a letter from the draft board and wanted to know the same question. And I thought, well, evidently with Federal, I get a deferment. And see, what they did is move a lot of war equipment, like LSTs, LCTs, and those kind of crafts, landing crafts, that were being built all over Kansas City, Kansas, Seneca, Illinois, on the Illinois River. And so I thought, well, I better go back down there. But I knew if I'd once get to work, you know, as really, and make, you know, good money, you never leave your job. You know what I mean? And if it hadn't been for the war, of course, the war changed a lot of people's plans. I'd have been up here and retired up here. I had a farm all picked out about opposite the mouth of the spillway. The lady was old and lived in Portland, and I'd hunt down there. I had written to her, that's a farm I was going to try to buy. And then I'd work up here and you could hunt and fish. And I thought it was just a paradise. But at any rate, I went back to work down there, and then in 44, I went over to Standard Oil of Indiana, and I worked with them 26 years as and retired from them in 1970. Always on the river, yeah. And during the course of years, well, during the war, we worked, when I worked with the federal, we'd move stuff out of Kansas City, War Department stuff, like LCTs, LCMs. And when I went over with Standard, see, the boats couldn't do what they wanted to do, their own work. They'd have to do what the War Department wanted to do. And at that time, we towed, when I went with Standard, we towed from Destrehan, Louisiana, a little above New Orleans, all the way up to above Pittsburgh to Hayes, Pennsylvania on the Monongahela. So during my working years on the river, I worked all the way from Louisiana up the Ohio to above Pittsburgh, and then we always did go up to Minneapolis from St. Louis and down to Carroll and up to Evansville. So I worked practically on all the rivers through the years, you know.
Well, when you were talking about making good money, did you make good money on the Fort Peck project? Was that a good sound?
Yes. I made, I didn't make as much as the dredge captains. I guess if we'd have kicked a little bit, we'd have probably got more. The dredge captain got $3,600 a year, which is only $300 a month. But at that time, it's a lot of money. I was getting $2,400, and Captain Leslie was getting $2,600. And but for a beginner, Your labor at Fort Peck at that time was $1.20 an hour, $9.60 a day, which was a good salary.
Yeah, the depression.
Yeah, that was welders, carpenters. That's what they got, $1.20 an hour. And boy, I'm telling you, that was a wonderful pay, and of course all of them didn't get that. That was more or less your top craftsman, and that was very good. And they had ample help, because it was really bad times. 34 was still part of the Depression, which started in 29, and I was lucky. I worked all the way through on boats, but it was with the on a government payroll, and since it was government payroll, we had to give 15% of our wages for unemployment, which went on for quite a number of years. But you were glad to have any kind of a job. Where today, you know, when you talk about wages like that, as a deckhand, I got $1,380 a year. Of course, you got your board with this. Uh-huh. And that is a little over $100 a month. And I thought I had a good job.
Uh-huh. Were you sending home money to your family? How were they doing?
Well, my father was working, and he was working in a shoe factory at Herman. That was about the only industry we had. And he was making roughly, I'd say, $15 or $18 a week, which wasn't much, but it was that much. And you were lucky if you had a job, really.
So were you a single man the whole time you were up here in Fort Peck?
I was a single man, and I was a single man till at age 47 I got married. And now we've been married 31 years, and I'm 78, and my wife was 80, 29th, just a couple of days ago. And we were both chipper, very thankful.
Well, people have told me that there were great dances in this area.
Oh, I tell you, this country up here, it was what you call the Primrose Path. If you wanted to get on it, you sure could. I was reading there in this magazine, well, I don't know, this or another one.